Part 2. Brotherhood in Spider-Man. One. Even after he'd slain a fair number of them, Saul Tarvitz was still unable to say with any certainty where the biology of the mega-arachnid stopped and their technology began. They were the most seamless things, a perfect fusion of artifice and organism. They did not wear their armor or carry their weapons. Their armor was an integument bonded to their anthropod shells, and they possessed weapons as naturally as a man might own fingers or a mouth. Tarvitz loathed them, and loved them too. He loathed them for their abominable want of human perfection. He loved them because they were genuinely testing foes, and in mastering them, the Emperor's children would take another stride closer to attaining their full potential.
"We always need a rival," his Lord Eidolon had once said, and the words had stuck forever in Tarvitz's mind. "A true rival, of considerable strength and fortitude. Only against such a rival can our prowess be properly measured."
There was more at stake here than the Legion's prowess, however, and Tarvitz understood that sullenly. Brother Astartes were in trouble, and this was a mission, though no one had dared actually use the term, of rescue. It was thoroughly improper to openly suggest that the Blood Angels needed rescuing. Reinforcement. That was the word they had been told to use, but it was hard to reinforce what you could not find. They had been on the surface of Murder for 66 hours, and had found no sign of the 140th Expedition Forces. Or even, for the most part, of each other. Lord Commander Eidolon had committed the entire company to the surface drop. The descent had been foul, worse than the warnings they had been given prior to the drop, and the warnings had been grim enough. Nightmarish atmospherics had scattered their drop pods like chaff, casting them wildly astray from their projected landing vectors. Tarvitz knew it was likely many pods hadn't even made it to the ground intact. He found himself one of two captains in charge of just over 30 men, around one-third of the company force, and all that had been able to regroup after planetfall. Due to the storm cover, they couldn't raise the fleet in orbit, nor could they raise Eidolon or any other part of the landing force. Presuming Eidolon and any other part of the landing force had survived. The whole situation smacked of abject failure, and failure was not a concept the Emperor's children cared to entertain. To turn failure into something else, there was little choice but to get on with the remit of the undertaking, so they spread out in a search pattern to find the brothers they had come to help. On the way, perhaps, they might reunite with other elements of their scattered force, or even find some geographical frame of reference. The drop site environs were disconcerting. Under an enamel-white sky, fizzling and blemished by the mega-arachnid shield storms, the land was an undulating plain of ferrous-red dust, from which a sea of gigantic grass stalks grew, grey-white like dirty ice. Each stalk, as thick as a man's plated thigh, rose up straight to a height of 20 meters, tough, dry, and bristly. They swished gently in the radioactive wind, but such was their size, at ground level, the air was filled with the creaking, moaning sound of their structures in motion. The Astartes moved through the groaning forest of stalks like lice in a wheat field. There was precious little lateral visibility. High above their heads, the nodding vertical shoots soared upwards and pointed incriminatingly at the curdled glare of the sky. Around them, the stalks had grown so close together that a man could see only a few meters in any direction. The bases of most of the grass stalks were thick with swollen black larvae. Sack things the size of a man's head clustered tumorously to the meter or so of stalk closest to the ground. The larvae did nothing but cling and, presumably, drink. As they did so, they made a weird, hissing, whistling noise that added to the eerie acoustics of the forest floor. Bull had suggested that the larvae might be infant forms of the enemy, and for the first few hours they had systematically destroyed all they'd found with flamers and blades. But the work was wearying and unending. There were larvae everywhere, and eventually they had chosen to forget it and ignore the hissing sacks. Besides, the fetid ichor that burst from the larvae when they were struck was damaging the edges of their weapons and scarring their armor where it splashed. Lucius, Tarvitz's fellow captain, had found the first tree, and called them all close to inspect it. It was a curious thing, apparently made of a calcified white stone, and it dwarfed the surrounding sea of stalks. It was shaped like a wide-capped mushroom, a 50-meter dome supported on a thick, squat trunk 10 meters broad. The dome was an intricate hemisphere of sharp, bone-white thorns, tangled and sharply pointed, the barbs some 2 or 3 meters in length.
"What is it for?" Tarvitz wondered.
"It's not for anything," Lucius replied. "It's a tree. It has no purpose."
In that, Lucius was wrong. Lucius was younger than Tarvitz, though they were both old enough to have seen many wonders in their lives. They were friends, except that the balance of their friendship was steeply and invisibly weighted in one direction. Saul and Lucius represented the bipolar aspect of their legion. Like all of the Emperor's children, they devoted themselves to the pursuit of martial perfection, but Saul was diligently grounded where Lucius was ambitious. Saul Tarvitz had long since realized that Lucius would one day outstrip him in honor and rank. Lucius would perhaps become a Lord Commander in due course, part of the aloof inner circle at the Legion's traditionally hierarchical core. Tarvitz didn't care. He was a file officer, born to the line, and had no desire for elevation. He was content to glorify the Primarch and the Emperor, beloved of all, by knowing his place and keeping it with unstinting devotion. Lucius mocked him playfully sometimes, claiming Tarvitz courted the common ranks because he couldn't win the respect of the officers. Tarvitz always laughed that off because he knew Lucius didn't properly understand. Saul Tarvitz followed the code exactly and took pride in that. He knew his perfect destiny was as a file officer. To crave more would have been overweening and imperfect. Tarvitz had standards and despised anyone who cast their own standards aside in the hunt for inappropriate goals. It was all about purity, not superiority. That's what the other legions always failed to understand. Barely 15 minutes after the discovery of the tree, the first of many they would find scattered throughout the creaking grasslands, they had their first dealings with the Megarachnid. The enemy's arrival had been announced by 3 signs. The larvae nearby had suddenly stopped hissing. The towering grass stalks had begun an abrupt shivering vibration, as if electrified. Then the Astartes had heard a strange chittering noise, coming closer. Tarvitz barely saw the enemy warriors during that first clash. They had come, thrilling and clattering, out of the grass forest, moving so fast they were silver blurs. The fight lasted 12 chaotic seconds, a period filled to capacity with gunshots and shouts and odd, weighty impacts. Then the enemy had vanished again, as fast as they had come. The stalks had stilled, and the larvae had resumed their hissing.
"Did you see them?"
asked Kirkort, reloading his bolter.
"I saw something," Tarvitz admitted, doing the same.
"Durlan's dead. So is Martius,"
Lucius announced casually, approaching them with something in his hand. Tarvitz couldn't quite believe what he had been told.
"That dead? Just dead?"
he asked Lucius. The fight surely hadn't lasted long enough to have included the passing of 2 veteran Astartes.
"Dead," nodded Lucius. "You can look upon their cadavers if you wish. They're over there. They were too slow."
Weapon raised, Tarvitz pushed through the swaying stalks, some of them broken and snapped over by frantic bolter fire. He saw the 2 bodies, tangled amid fallen white shoots on the red earth, their beautiful purple and gold armor sawn apart and running with blood. Dismayed, he looked away from the butchery. "Find Varus," he told Kirkort, and the man went off to locate the apothecary.
"Did we kill anything?" Bull asked.
"I hit something," Lucius said proudly, "but I cannot find the body. It left this behind."
He held out the thing in his hand. It was a limb, or part of a limb. Long, slender, hard. The main part of it, 1 meter long, was a gently curved blade, apparently made of brushed zinc or galvanized iron. It came to an astonishingly sharp point. It was thin, no thicker than a grown man's wrist. The long blade ended in a widening joint, which attached it to a thicker limb section. This part was also armoured with mottled grey metal, but came to an abrupt end where Lucius's shot had blown it off. The broken end, in cross-section, revealed a skin of metal surrounding a sleeve of natural anthropoid chitin around an inner mass of pink, wet meat.
"Is it an arm?" Bull asked.
"It's a sword," Katz corrected.
"A sword with a joint," Bull snorted. "And meat inside."
Lucius grasped the limb, just above the joint, and brandished it like a sabre. He swung it at the nearest stalk, and it went clean through. With a lingering crash, the massive dry shoot toppled over, tearing into others as it fell. Lucius started laughing. Then he cried out in pain and dropped the limb. Even the base part of the limb, above the joint, had an edge, and it was so sharp that the force of his grip had bitten through his gauntlet. "It has cut me," Lucius complained, poking at his ruptured glove. Tarvitz looked down at the limb, bent and still on the red soil.
"Little wonder they can slice us to ribbons."
Half an hour later, when the stalks shivered again, Tarvitz met his first mega-arachnid, face to face. He killed it, but it was a close-run thing, over in a couple of seconds. From that encounter, Saul Tarvitz began to understand why Kytus Frome had named the world Murder. The great warship exploded like a breaching whale from the smudge of unlight that was its retranslation point, and returned to the silent, physical cosmos of real space again, with a shivering impact. It had translated 12 weeks earlier by the shipboard clocks, and had made a journey that ought to have taken 18 weeks. Great powers had been put into play to expedite the transit, powers that only a war master could call upon. It coasted for about 6 million kilometers, trailing the last luminous tendrils of plasmic flare from its immense bulk, like remorae, until strobing flashes of unlight to stern announced the belated arrival of its consorts. 10 light cruisers and 5 mass conveyance troopships. The stragglers lit their real space engines and hurried wearily to join formation with the huge flagship. As they approached, like a school of pups swimming close to their mighty parent, the flagship ignited its own drives and led them in. Towards 1:40:20. Towards Murder. Forward array detectors pinged as they tasted the magnetic and energetic profiles of other ships at high anchor around the system's fourth planet, 80 million kilometers ahead. The local sun was yellow and hot, and billowed with loud, charged particles. As it advanced at the head of the trailing flotilla, the flagship broadcast its standard greeting document in Vox, Vox-supplemented PICT, War Council code, and astro-telepathic forms. "This is the vengeful spirit of the 63rd Expedition. The vessel approaches with peaceful intent, as an ambassador of the Imperium of Man. House your guns and stand to. Make acknowledgement." On the bridge of the vengeful spirit, Master Comnemnus sat at his station and waited. Given its great size and number of personnel, the bridge around him was curiously quiet. There was just a murmur of low voices and the whir of instrumentation. The ship itself was protesting loudly. Undignified creaks and seismic moans issued from its immense hull and layered decks as the superstructure relaxed and settled from the horrendous torsion stresses of warp translation. Boaz Comnemnus knew most of the sounds like old friends, and could almost anticipate them. He'd been part of the ship for a long time, and knew it as intimately as a lover's body. He waited, braced, for erroneous creaks, for the sudden chime of defect alarms. So far, all was well. He glanced at the master companion of Vox, who shook his head. He switched his gaze to Ingmei Singh, who, though blind, knew full well he was looking at her.
"No response, Master," she said.
"Repeat," he ordered. He wanted that signal response, but more particularly, he was waiting for the fix. It was taking too long. Comnemnus drummed his steel fingers on the edge of his master console, and deck officers all around him stiffened. They knew and feared that sign of impatience. Finally, an adjutant hurried over from the navigation pit with the wafer slip. The adjutant might have been about to apologize for the delay, but Comnenus glanced up at him with a whir of augmetic lenses. The whir said, "I do not expect you to speak." The adjutant simply held the wafer out for inspection. Comnenus read it, nodded, and handed it back.
"Make it known and recorded," he said.
The adjutant paused long enough for another deck officer to copy the wafer for the principal transit log, then hurried up the rear staircase of the bridge to the strategium deck. There, with a salute, he handed it to the duty master, who took it, turned, and walked 20 paces to the plated glass doors of the sanctum, where he handed it in turn to the master bodyguard. The master bodyguard, a massive Astartes in gold custodian's armor, read the wafer quickly, nodded, and opened the doors. He passed the wafer to the solemn, robed figure of Malagurst, who was waiting just inside. Malagurst read the wafer too, nodded in turn, and shut the doors again.
"Location is confirmed and entered into the log," Malagurst announced to the sanctum. 1:40:20.
Seated in a high-backed chair that had been drawn up close to the window ports to afford a better view of the starfield outside, the War Master took a deep, steady breath.
"Determination of passage so noted," he replied. "Let my acknowledgement be a matter of record."
The 20 waiting scribes around him scratched the details down in their manifests, bowed, and withdrew.
"Malagurst."
The War Master turned his head to look at his equerry.
"Send Boas my compliments, please."
"Yes, Lord."
The War Master rose to his feet. He was dressed in full ceremonial war gear, gleaming gold and frost white, with a vast mantle of purple scale skin draped across his shoulders. The eye of terror stared from his breastplate. He turned to face the 10 Astartes officers gathered in the center of the room, and each one of them felt that the eye was regarding him with particular, unblinking scrutiny.
"We await your orders, Lord," said Abaddon.
Like the other 9, he was wearing battle plate with a floor-length cloak, his crested helm carried in the crook of his left arm.
"And we're where we're supposed to be," said Torgadon, "and alive, which is always a good start."
A broad smile crossed the War Master's face.
"Indeed it is, Taric."
He looked into the eyes of each officer in turn.
"My friends, it seems we have an alien war to contest. This pleases me. Proud as I am of our accomplishments on 6319, that was a painful fight to prosecute. I can't derive satisfaction from a victory over our own kind, no matter how wrong-headed and stubborn their philosophies. It limits the soldier in me, and inhibits my relish of war. And we are all warriors, you and I, made for combat, bred, trained, and disciplined. Except you, Pear."
Horus smirked, nodding at Abaddon and Luke Sedere.
"You kill until I have to tell you to stop."
"And even then, you have to raise your voice," added Torgadon.
Most of them laughed.
"So, an alien war is a delight to me,"
the War Master continued, still smiling.
"A clear and simple foe, an opportunity to wage war without restraint, regret, or remorse. Let us go and be warriors for a while, pure and undiluted."
"Hear, hear,"
cried the ancient Yactan crews, businesslike and sober, clearly bothered by Torgadon's constant levity. The other 9 were more modest in their assent. Horus led them out of the sanctum onto the strategium deck. The 4 captains of the Morneval and the company commanders, Sedere of the 13th, Cruz of the 3rd, Targost of the 7th, Mar of the 18th, Moy of the 19th, and Goshen of the 25th.
"Let's have tactical,"
the War Master said. Malagurst was waiting, ready. As he motioned with his control wand, detailed hololithic images shimmered into place above the dais. They showed a general profile of the system, with orbital paths delineated, and the position and motion of tracked vessels. Horus gazed up at the hololithic graphics and reached out. Actuator sensors built into the fingertips of his gauntlets allowed him to rotate the hololithic display and bring certain segments into magnification.
29 craft,"
he said.
"I thought the 140th was 18 vessels strong."
"So we were told, Lord,"
Malagurst replied. As soon as they had stepped out of the sanctum, they had started conversing in Chthonic, so as to preserve tactical confidence whilst in earshot of the bridge personnel. Though Horus had not been raised on Chthonia, uncommonly for a Primarch, he had not matured on the cradle world of his legion. He spoke it fluently. In fact, he spoke it with the particular hard palatal edge and rough vowels of a Western Hemispheric ganger, the commonest and roughest of Chthonia's feral castes. It had always amused Loken to hear that accent. Early on, he had assumed it was because that's how the War Master had learned it, from just such a speaker, but he doubted that now. Horus never did anything by accident. Loken believed that the War Master's rough Chthonic accent was a deliberate affectation, so that he would seem, to the men, as honest and low-born as any of them. Malagurst had consulted a data slate provided by a waiting deck officer. "I confirm the 140th expedition was given a complement of 18 vessels."
"Then what are these others?" asked Aximand. "Enemy ships?"
"We're awaiting sensor profile analysis, Captain," Malagurst replied. "And there has been no response to our signals as yet."
"Tell Master Comnenus to be more emphatic," the War Master told his equerry.
"Should I instruct him to form our components into a battle line, Lord?" Malagurst asked.
"I'll consider it," the War Master said.
Malagurst limped away down the platform steps onto the main bridge to speak to Boaz Comnenus.
"Should we form a battle line?" Horus asked his commanders.
"Could the additional profiles be alien vessels?" Cruz wondered.
"It doesn't look like a battle spread, Yakton,"
Aximan replied.
"And Frome said nothing about enemy vessels."
"They're ours," said Loken.
The War Master looked over at him.
"You think so, Garbiel?"
"It seems evident to me, sir. The hits show a spread of ships at high anchor. Imperial anchorage formation. Others must have responded to the call for assistance."
Loken trailed off and suddenly fought back an embarrassed smile.
"You knew that all along, of course, my lord."
"I was just wondering who else might have been sharp enough to recognize the pattern," Horus smiled.
Cruz shook his head with a grin, sheepish at his own mistake. The War Master nodded towards the display.
"So, what's this big fellow here? That's a barge."
"The Misery Cord?" suggested Cruz.
No, that's the Misery Cord. And what's this about?"
Horus leaned forwards and ran his fingers across the hard light display.
"It looks like music. Something like music. Who's transmitting music?"
"Outstation relays," Abaddon said, studying his own data slate.
"Beacons?
The 140th reported 30 beacons in the system grid. Xenos. Their broadcasts are repeating and untranslatable."
"Really? They have no ships, but they have outstation beacons."
Horus reached out and changed the display to a close breakdown of scatter patterns.
"This is untranslatable."
"So the 140th said," said Abaddon.
"Have we taken their word for that?"
asked the War Master.
"I imagine we have," said Abaddon.
"There's sense in this,"
Horus decided, peering at the luminous graphics.
"I want this run. I want us to run it. Start with standard numeric blocks. With respect to the 140th, I don't intend to take their word for anything. Cursed awful job they've done here so far."
Abaddon nodded and stepped aside to speak to one of the waiting deck officers and have the order enacted.
"You said it looks like music," Loken said.
"What?"
"You said it looks like music, sir," Loken repeated.
"An interesting word to choose." The War Master shrugged.
"It's mathematical. But there's a sequential rhythm to it. It's not random. Music and maths, Garvey. Two sides of a coin. This is deliberately structured. Lord knows which idiot in the 140th fleet decided this was untranslatable."
Loken nodded.
"You see that just by looking at it?" he asked.
"Isn't it obvious?"
Horus replied. Malagos returned. "Master Comnenus confirms all contacts are Imperial," he said. holding out another wafer slip of printout. "Other units have been arriving this last few weeks in response to the calls for aid. Most of them are Imperial Army conveyances en route to Carolus Star, but the big vessel is the Proud Heart, 3rd Legion, the Emperor's Children, a full company, under the command privilege of Lord Commander Eidolon."
"So, they beat us to it. How are they doing?"
Malagurst shrugged. "It would seem not well, Lord," he said. The planet's official designation in the Imperial Registry was 140-20, it being the 20th world subjected to compliance by the fleet of the 140th Expedition. But that was inaccurate, as clearly the 140th had not achieved anything like compliance. Still, the Emperor's Children had used the number to begin with, for to do otherwise would have been an insult to the honour of the Blood Angels. Prior to arrival, Lord Commander Eidolon had briefed his Astartes comprehensively. The initial transmissions of the 140th Expedition had been clear and succinct. Kytus Frome, captain of the 3 Blood Angels companies that formed the marrow of the 140th, had reported Xenos hostilities a few days after his forces had touched down on the world's surface. He had described very capable things, like upright beetles, but made of, or shod in, metal. Each one is twice the height of a man, and very belligerent. Assistance may be required if their numbers increase. After that, his relayed communiques had been somewhat patchy and intermittent. Fighting had grown thicker and more savage, and the Xenos forms appeared not to lack in numbers. A week later, and his transmissions were more urgent. "There is a race here that resists us, and which we cannot easily overcome. They refuse to admit communication with us, or any parley. They spill from their lairs. I find myself admiring their metal, though they are not made as we are. Their martial schooling is fine indeed, a worthy foe, one that might be written about in our annals." A week after that, the expedition's messages had become rather more simple, sent by the master of the fleet instead of Frome. "The enemy here is formidable, and quite outweighs us. To take this world, the full force of the Legio is required. We humbly submit a request for reinforcement at this time." Frome's last message, relayed from the surface a fortnight later by the expedition fleet, had been a tinny rasp of generally indecipherable noise. All the articulacy and purpose of his words had been torn apart by the feral distortion. The only cogent thing that had come through was his final utterance. Each word had seemed to be spoken with inhuman effort. "This world is murder." And so they had named it. The task force of the Emperor's Children was comparatively small in size. Just a company of the Legion's main strength, conveyed by the battle barge Proudheart, under the command of Lord Eidolon. After a brief peacekeeping tour of newly compliant worlds in the Satyr-Lanxus belt, they had been en route to rejoin their Primarch and brethren companies at Carolus Star to begin a mass advance into the Lesser Bifold Cluster. However, during their transit, the 140th Expedition had begun its requests for assistance. The task force had been the closest Imperial unit fit to respond. Lord Eidolon had requested immediate permission from his Primarch to alter course and go to the expedition's aid. Fulgrim had given his authority at once. The Emperor's Children would never leave their Astartes brothers in jeopardy. Eidolon had been given his Primarch's instant, unreserved blessing to reroute and support the beleaguered expedition. Other forces were rushing to assist. It was said a detachment of Blood Angels was on its way, as was a heavyweight response from the War Master himself, dispatched from the 63rd Expedition. At best, the closest of them was still many days off. Lord Eidolon's task force was the interim measure, critical response the first to the scene. Eidolon's battle barge had joined with the operational vessels of the 140th Expedition at high anchor above 140-20. The 140th Expedition was a small, compact force of 18 carriers, mass conveyances, and escorts, supporting the noble battle barge Misericord. Its martial composition was 3 companies of Blood Angels under Captain Frome, and 4,000 men of the Imperial Army, with allied armour, but no Mechanicum force. Mathaniel August, master of the 140th Fleet, had welcomed Eidolon and his commanders aboard the barge. Tall and slender, with a forked white beard, August was fretful and nervous.
"I am gratified at your quick response, Lord," he told Eidolon.
"Where is Frome?" Eidolon had asked bluntly. August had shrugged helplessly.
"Where is the commander of the army divisions?"
A second pitiful shrug.
"They are all down there."
Down there, on murder. The world was a hazy grey orb, mottled with storm patterning in the atmosphere. Drawn to the lonely system by the curious, untranslatable broadcasts of the outstation beacons, a clear and manifest trace of sentient life, the 140th expedition had focused its attentions on the fourth planet, the only orb in the star's orbit with an atmosphere. Sensor sweeps had detected abundant vital traces, though nothing had answered their signals. 50 Blood Angels had dropped first, in landers, and had simply disappeared. Previously calm weather cycles had mutated into violent tempests the moment the landers had entered the atmosphere, like an allergic reaction, and swallowed them up. Due to the suddenly volatile climate, communication with the surface was impossible. Another 50 had followed, and had similarly vanished. That was when Frome and the fleet officers had begun to suspect that the life forms of 140-20 somehow commanded their own weather systems as a defense. The immense storm fronts, later dubbed shield storms, that had risen up to meet the surface-bound landers, had probably obliterated them. After that, Frome had used drop pods, the only vehicles that seemed to survive the descent. Frome had led the third wave himself, and only partial messages had been received from him subsequently, even though he'd taken an astro-telepath with him to counter the climatic Vox interference. It was a grim story. Section by section, August had committed the Astartes and army forces in his expedition to surface drops in a vain attempt to respond to Frome's broken pleas for support. They had either been destroyed by the storms or lost in the impenetrable maelstrom below. The shield storms, once roused, would not die away. There were no clean surface picks, no decent topographic scans, no uplinks or viable communication lines. 140-20 was an abyss from which no one returned.
"We'll be going in blind," Eidolon had told his officers. "Drop pod descent." "Perhaps you should wait, Lord," August had suggested. "We have word that a Blood Angel's force is en route to relieve Captain Frome, and the Lunar Wolves are but 4 days away. Combined, perhaps, you might better—"
That had decided it. Tarvitz knew Lord Eidolon had no intention of sharing any glory with the War Master's elite. His lord was relishing the prospect of demonstrating the excellence of his company by rescuing the cohorts of a rival legion, whether the word rescuing was used or not. The nature of the deed and the comparisons that it made would speak for themselves. Eidolon had sanctioned the drop immediately.